From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Alabama, Florida, BCS bowl games. These abstract words are in the air, but what do they mean? Ahead on Only a Game, Dan Wetzel will provide the concrete answers. Also, angering Buffalo, perhaps the Bills dally with Mistress Toronto. Recounting all 604 holes of Tiger Woods' abbreviated 2008 golf season, and scientific geniuses express their research through a dance competition. Also ahead, a former NFL quarterback and stroke sufferer screens NFL alumni for cardiovascular risks.
I had never been essentially sick a day in my life prior to that, and I had the old football player's attitude that I was going to be fine and I didn't have to go to the doctor, even though I was a doctor and I should have known better.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Alabama, Oklahoma, Texas, USC. I see I've left out Florida, so shame on careless me. Utah, Texas Tech, and Boise can't forget Ball State. Each with just one loss or none can stake a claim to great. Joining me now to help separate the great from the merely near great college football teams as the time to heap more abuse upon the bowl championship series draws ever nearer is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, always good to be on.
Today in the Georgia Dome, the Florida Gators will face the Crimson Tide of Alabama to determine the SEC winner and one half of the BCS championship game, which will be played in Miami on the 8th of January. Today's game is being billed as a contrast of styles. What do you expect will happen when Florida's speedy offense meets a very physical Alabama team?
Well, I think Florida's the better team, although Alabama's undefeated. But Alabama has great size and strength on the line, ball control offense. They are capable of scoring a lot of points, though, but Florida has the skill position advantage. Great quarterback Tim Tebow, the reigning Heisman Trophy winner, still competing for a second straight Heisman, which would make him only the second player in the history of college football to do that. Florida lost one game by 1 point earlier in the year to a decent Mississippi team, and that's kind of set them back. But everyone's really excited because it's the closest thing what we have to a real kind of a playoff game. Either team could still win the national title, and either team obviously would be knocked out with a loss.
Alabama is ranked number one in the AP poll and in the BCS standings. Florida is number two on the AP, but only number four in the BCS rankings. Without engaging in enough BCS talk to send our listeners rushing to television or video games rather than the radio, should or shouldn't this game determine both halves of the BCS championship game?
Well, there's some argument that if it's a particularly dramatic game and Florida were to win, say, a triple overtime, by 1 point or something like that, does Alabama then with one loss, is there one loss, should that disqualify them when everyone else that they would be competing with for the second spot also have a loss? And particularly if Oklahoma were to lose, Texas has one loss, they're not playing. Nobody knows. One of the great problems with the BCS is it's basically a human opinion deal. There are some computers, but two-thirds of this is decided by human opinion, yet there's no criteria given to the humans on what they should base their vote on. So they can choose any criteria they want. Some people say it's who you beat. Some say it's who you lost to. Some say it's how you won. Some say it's how you lost. Some say it's where you lost, whether your offense is statistically ranked, could be your favorite color. We had a guy last week who forgot to vote. So anything goes. It'd be very hard to design a more ridiculous system and least satisfying, which is why year after year, show after show, I'm on here complaining about it, but the fans are complaining about it. I'll give you the other example now, Oklahoma versus Texas. They had to choose which team had a better season, and the voters chose Oklahoma. Well, the voters and the computer said Oklahoma. Texas beat Oklahoma by 10 points. Which led to, the idea that the BCS would say Germany actually was the number one army in World War II because they had a much better body of work. Sure, the United States beat them head-to-head.
Yeah, I don't like these war football comparisons. I think we got to move on. I'm very unhappy with the war football comparisons. But why is this game between Alabama and Florida being played in Georgia?
Because there's money to be had in Georgia, them hills of Georgia. The bowl games make a lot of money. Now, this isn't a bowl game. This is a de facto bowl game. Conferences realized that they would create their own bowl and call it a conference championship game. And as a result, there's about the SEC will rake in about $14 to $15 million in revenue for this game, not counting the packet part of the package with the CBS to do the game. So, normal bowl games, you have independent businesses and cities that put them on, and they cut into the profits, which has never made any sense. One of the worst deals in American sports. But in this one, the conferences have smartened up and just basically made their own separate second round of bowl games.
Number 2 Oklahoma will host number 20 Missouri tonight. What's at stake for the Sooners and Tigers aside from Big 12 bragging rights?
Not much for the Tigers. You know, they can win and get to a bigger bowl game, but it would mainly just be the spoiler. For Oklahoma, if they win, they would, you know, almost assuredly reach the title game. They would have an inside track on being one of the two teams for the title game. Oklahoma, I would expect to win that thing. They're scoring over 60 points a game the last 5 or 6 weeks. They have really one of the best offenses you'll ever see in college football. If you ever thought football was boring and there wasn't enough scoring, just watch Oklahoma. It's like watching basketball on grass.
I like that. That's a nice comparison. That's very good. Which of today's games that we have not yet discussed should we have discussed?
You know, really, there's two games. You have Army-Navy. I guess you could always discuss just because of the caliber of the players and the tradition of the game. People enjoy watching that no matter what the record is for those teams. Great tradition. But for the most part, the other games really don't matter. There's only really that SEC game and then waiting to see if Missouri stands a puncher's chance against Oklahoma. But I think you can pretty much wrap up your entire college football viewing really just watching the SEC game for 3.5 hours and then maybe the first 15 minutes of the Big 12 game, and then you could, you know, look like a hero if you've ignored your wife or girlfriend or boyfriend or whoever it is through the fall and say, let's go to the movies. Nothing to see here.
You know, with that puncher's chance, you compared football to boxing, and earlier you had successfully compared it to basketball. Next time we talk, see if you can work baseball and maybe ice hockey into it, all right?
I'll do what I can do.
Okay. Dan Wetzel covers college football and other sports for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thanks very much for joining me.
All right, thank you.
November's Grey Cup game marks the end of the Canadian pro football season, but tomorrow afternoon, the National Football League's Buffalo Bills will host the Miami Dolphins not in Orchard Park, but in Toronto. As Dave Naylor reports, it's an event that's stirring emotions on both sides of the border.
It's a soggy day in Orchard Park, New York, just outside of Buffalo, and the parking lot is full. This is Buffalo Bills country, where every ticket has been sold this season for a team that hasn't reached the playoffs for the past 8 years. And Bills fans will tell you, it's hard to find more diehard football fans anywhere.
I mean, I don't know if there's any fans in NFL that are more passionate than the Buffalo fans.
It's not about the money, it's about the fans. You can have a lot of money in Toronto, but Toronto had a ton of money and not even half the fans Buffalo had. That's all there is to it. You got to have the fans to have the team. Go Buffalo.
But Western New York is an area that was economically depressed long before the current financial crisis hit. The population here is shrinking as people have fled the region in search of prosperity. Now there is fear the Bills might do the same, especially since for the first time, fans here like those huddled in the rain last Sunday will be watching the Bills not in person, but on television from a home game in Toronto.
Well, my father-in-law is just, he's a ticket holder here for 10 years, and he says it's the beginning of the end. You know, it's like inevitable. The Buffalo's going somewhere else, and it's like the initial sign of it happening.
So is it a crack in the door? Is that the way you see it?
That's what it looks like. Team leaving a city like Buffalo, which, you know, loves their team, and they're putting a big rivalry game in Toronto.
The idea of the Bills playing 8 games over 5 years in Toronto has certainly jump-started fears about the team's future. Toronto is just a 90-minute drive away, but unlike Buffalo, it's an extremely prosperous city with a huge corporate base, where ticket prices to see the Bills are roughly 400% higher than in Buffalo. Mark Gaughan covers the Bills for the Buffalo News. He says there's no secret why the team was willing to move some of its games to Toronto.
Well, they're making a lot more money by putting a game in Toronto, and maybe 3 million more or 4 million more. The problem is, in the current economics of the NFL in 2008, the large market teams are stretching their advantage in terms of increasing their revenues. Big market teams like Dallas and the New York teams are coming online with these giant new stadiums that are going to blow away the rest of the league in terms of revenue and, long story short, increase costs for the small market teams. So the small market teams need to get creative and find ways to not fall behind so far in terms of bringing in dollars.
They're the Buffalo Bills. They're not the Toronto Bills. Stay in Buffalo.
Very disappointed. A rivalry game away from home? What do you think? Toronto fans don't have the same kind of fan atmosphere as Buffalo City, and plus it's a dome.
Is it an insult to Bills fans to take that game away?
A little bit. Rivalry game is up in Toronto. Canadian.
So if Bills fans aren't happy about seeing some of their games move to Toronto, who is? Well, certainly not a lot of Canadians who worry Buffalo's game against Miami this weekend is the first step towards the Bills eventually setting up shop full-time in Toronto. The Bills are owned by 90-year-old founder Ralph Wilson, who says the team will be sold by his estate after his passing. That makes ardent Canadian Football League fans worried about what it might mean to their league. Derek Russell is a Toronto Argonauts season ticket holder and a diehard CFL fan.
The league itself could survive, but maybe not the Toronto Argonauts, maybe not the Hamilton Tiger Cats. You would still have Canadian Football League teams in Regina and Calgary and Montreal. I don't know if there's enough sponsorship money and enough fan interest to go around to having two teams based in the same center.
It's not just fans who are concerned about the Bills setting up shop in Toronto. So is the league itself. So concerned that it tried to strike a deal with the NFL this past year that would provide some protection for Canadian football in the event of an NFL invasion. The NFL wasn't interested. Mark Cohan is the CFL's commissioner. He said the league's main priority is to see the Bills stay where they are.
The Canadian Football League has been around for over 100 years. We're the oldest professional sports league in North America, actually. We just finished our Grey Cup with over 3.5 million Canadians watching on television, 66,000 people, you know, attending in Montreal. You know, if one game helps Buffalo stay in Buffalo, we support that. If it goes beyond that, then we have some serious concerns about how it would affect our teams in Southern Ontario, both in Hamilton and Toronto.
There are, however, lots of Canadians who do want to see NFL football in Canada. Although sky-high ticket prices made sales slow, it's anticipated Sunday's game will be close to a sellout. For a game some fans hope, and others fear, will be a glimpse of the future. For Only a Game, I'm Dave Naylor in Orchard Park, New York.
Yesterday afternoon in Las Vegas, O.J. Simpson was sentenced to up to 33 years in prison, though he may be eligible for parole in 9. Simpson, the 61-year-old Pro Football Hall of Famer, had been convicted on October 12th of 12 criminal charges, including armed robbery and kidnapping. Following the sentencing, Judge Jackie Glass refused to permit Simpson to go free on bail pending an appeal, and he was led away to prison. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Not much has gone right for Kazuki Ganaha since he began taking intravenous infusions of garlic. First, Ganaha, who played for Kawasaki Frontinale in the J-League, lost his spot on the Japanese national soccer team and was suspended by Kawasaki for 6 games for violating the J-League's rule against intravenous drips. Never mind that garlic is not on anyone's list of banned substances, and forget the fact that it was the club doctor who put Ganaha on the drip. Now the player, who was fined almost $100,000, has been dropped by his club team. What's left to say? This unhappy circumstance in which Ganaha-san has found himself, except that it stinks.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a dance competition featuring interpretations of doctoral research. No kidding. But first, the average life expectancy of American males is about 76 years. Many estimates put the average for former NFL players at 55.
An organization founded by a former NFL quarterback is working to improve that number by screening the cardiovascular health of the league's alumni, many of whom are traveling vast distances to take advantage of the free testing. Only a Game's Doug Tribou has the story.
It's a cold, rainy November Saturday morning in Danvers, Massachusetts. And inside the Beverly Hospital at Danvers Cardiovascular Center, 35 former National Football League players are swapping stories and joking around while they wait to get some serious information about their health.
I'm in front of you, John, right?
Huh?
I'm in front of you.
No,
right?
I just came up.
I was here before you.
No, you weren't.
Retired players, ranging in age from their early 30s to early 70s, are here for a comprehensive screening that will tell them if they're at risk for heart attacks or strokes. The free screening was organized by the nonprofit organization, the Living Heart Foundation. Founder Dr. Archie Roberts says the NFL's massive linemen might be the first people to come to mind, but the screenings are important for all former players.
That 300-plus-pound lineman could have perfect test results, meaning for the individual, you can't judge, oh, there's a big lineman, that lineman is going to be at high cardiovascular risk. It's not necessarily so.
Roberts understands the rigors of playing professional football and the importance of cardiovascular health. He was drafted by the New York Jets, spent 4 years on the Cleveland Browns preseason practice squad while attending medical school, and in 1967 was a backup quarterback for the Miami Dolphins. After his playing career, he became a heart surgeon. But despite advising thousands of patients to see their doctors regularly and closely monitor their heart health, Roberts failed to take his own advice, and in 1997, while giving a lecture, he had a stroke.
I had never been essentially sick a day in my life prior to that, and I had the old football player's attitude that I was going to be fine and I didn't have to go to the doctor, even though I was the doctor and I should have known better.
Now 66 years old, Roberts has made a full recovery. But the stroke inspired him to create the Living Heart Foundation to promote heart health awareness. The current program began in 2003, and since then, more than 1,400 former NFL players have been tested at regional screenings all over the country. Today, Beverly Hospital at Danvers is providing doctors, technicians, and equipment set up in several testing rooms. They collect basic information, weight, blood pressure, and diet and exercise habits. The players also attend seminars like this one run by a nutritionist.
Do you guys have any other questions about diet, nutrition at all?
Tuna's not good with mayonnaise, though, right?
It's really good with mayonnaise.
It's tasty.
The process also features cutting-edge screening methods, including the plaque test, a blood test which identifies an enzyme that may be a precursor to coronary heart disease. Players also undergo CT scans and echocardiograms. Dave O'Brien understands the importance of getting tested. O'Brien was a lineman for three teams in the mid-1960s. The NFL Players Association is one of a number of organizations that support the Living Heart Foundation's work. Now 67, O'Brien recently went through a screening at an NFLPA convention in Puerto Rico. Doctors there spotted a potentially dangerous buildup in his carotid artery.
They conducted more tests, and when I got back to Boston with the help of Dr. Roberts, they connected me with a specialist, and it led to some changes in my medicines and a more aggressive treatment of the conditions that they found in Puerto Rico. So it turned out to be a great thing.
O'Brien has since shared his story with the Boston chapters of two retired players' organizations to encourage the men to get tested. Dr. Roberts says one of the Living Heart Foundation's findings that surprised him the most came when comparing the largest former players in their database, mostly linemen, with other large people who were not athletes. Roberts says the cardiovascular profiles were similar.
And what it means is being an NFL football player did not have deleterious nor necessarily beneficial health effects when it comes to cardiovascular disease with the aging process and the mean age of both groups was about 52 years of age.
Roberts says that although their experience as elite athletes did not translate into any added heart benefits later in life, the players remained more motivated to stay active than the average person. But nagging injuries are a common topic when the men talk about the exercising they do today. Steve Grogan was a quarterback for the New England Patriots from 1975 to 1990. He's had four knee surgeries and an operation to replace a disc in his neck. He has also developed back problems since his career ended.
I can't run or jog. I have to walk, and which is fine. I mean, I try to stay active and walk as much as possible and lift some, and you just learn to do what you can do with the abilities you have left. I think as we're all getting older, I'm at least curious as to what my body's doing and what kind of shape my heart's in, because I know I'm not in the kind of condition I used to be in.
Dr. Roberts says with more players coming in for repeat screenings, the foundation is entering the next phase of its work, analyzing the long-term results of players' lifestyles and medical care.
So we can learn what the relationship is between abnormal testing and outcomes, because then we will learn what are the most important things that we have to change to reduce bad outcomes, such as heart attack and stroke.
And have the players taken what they've learned about diet and exercise to heart? Dave O'Brien is optimistic.
Well, I have more great intentions. And I have made some modifications. I think I'm more aware of the effects of various diets, for instance, and the importance of keeping your weight in check.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou in Danvers, Massachusetts.
It's not unusual for the Sugar Plum Fairy to dance in December. After all, the Nutcracker Ballet has become a favorite across the globe. But this particular Sugar Plum Fairy comes to us from Australia via YouTube. And instead of celebrating the bravery of young Clara and the Nutcracker Prince, she's delivering marshmallow glucose to dancers representing the beta cells of the human pancreas. A fifth dancer leaps around with a flashlight to represent the crux of this particular Sugar Plum Fairy's PhD thesis, the effect of vitamin D on insulin production. Why would graduate student Sue Lin Lau be doing such a thing? Because the gonzo scientist challenged her to do it in the second annual Dance Your PhD contest. The gonzo scientist himself, John Bohannon, joins me now on the line. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks.
You gave graduate students, postdocs, and professors 6 weeks to create and film a dance based on their scientific research. And since scientists are pretty busy people and not really known for their dancing ability, you couldn't have gotten more than, what, 2-3 entries?
Well, that's what I'd feared. But the amazing thing was that in the end, about 100 scientists took part, producing 3 dozen dances.
Well, obviously, our scientists are not busy enough doing science.
Well, if you watch every single dance and read the accompanying text that each of the scientists wrote, you actually learn a lot of science. So I think a lot of people feel this is okay because it falls within public outreach.
Well, I'm curious. You talk about the quality of the science and the quality of the dance. How do you decide a winner? Is there some relationship between the two, 60-40, 50-50?
So that was tricky. I worked this out the first time around. I said to the judges first, watch this dance as if you knew nothing about the science. Just judge it on its merits as a dance. Then put on your science hat and say, how cleverly did they extract a piece of their research to translate it? And that's a hard task, especially if you've got a very complex PhD. You can't just tell the whole story with every detail. You have to choose some nuanced inner part of it. And so then they had to judge how well they extracted that. And then the final category was how well did they bridge those two things? How well did they bridge art and science? And each of those was a 10-point scale for a possible total of 30.
As I mentioned earlier, scientists are not generally the best dancers at the prom or the spring social or at their reunions. Were you worried?
I challenge you on that, sir.
Oh, you do? Oh, excellent. Well, tell me about it. Perhaps I'm completely wrong.
Well, so, you know, I had the same notion until I became a scientist. My dad's a scientist. Actually, maybe he's not a good example because he's pretty wild on the dance floor.
But I went to a number of scientific conferences back before I was a journalist, when I was a scientist, and I always had the most amazing time at the dances. It's like a wedding. You know, it starts off incredibly awkward, and then in the case of scientists, there's always that one Russian postdoc. You know, I don't know why. I think maybe it's the same guy who shows up at all these conferences. And he just gets this thing going, and then eventually I find the scientists are amazing dancers.
All right. Well, I'll withdraw the question, although I'm glad I asked it because I enjoyed the answer.
Well, you've now seen about 100 scientists dancing.
I have seen bits and pieces of a great many scientists dancing, and my only hope is that fans of serious dance won't be put off by the titles of some of these performances, because it would be a real shame to miss, for example, resolving pathways of functional coupling in human hemoglobin using quantitative low-temperature isoelectric focusing of asymmetric mutant hybrids.
Isn't that just beautiful?
Winners, of course, get a chance to see their works reimagined by an actual professional choreographer. The finished works will be performed at the annual meeting for the American Association of the Advancement of Science in February. Will those dances, do you think, be similar to what we've already seen on YouTube?
I doubt it, actually, for two reasons. One is that I think the choreographers who are creating those dances right now as we speak will be mindful of creating something fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And the second reason is that they're not interpreting the PhD of these scientists, which is what generated the YouTube dance. Instead, I've asked each scientist to hand over some current research, currently published research. And their task this week and next is to answer any question that those choreographers have until they actually understand the science.
I see. And so did you pick choreographers who would at least be able to ask intelligent questions?
Well, it was a self-selecting process. So the choreographers who were the most interested in taking part in this project are hidden science geeks, in fact. Some of them are actually married to scientists.
This is the second Dance Your PhD contest. How did the idea for the first one come to you?
I was drunk, honestly. I just want you to know the reality. You could also use this answer. There was a big party that was going to happen in Vienna with a molecular biologist DJ. He made music that was based on samples of noise taken from molecular biology labs.
Oh.
So DNA sequencers, the mating dances of fruit flies. There are a lot of bizarre noises in the laboratory. Anyway, so he was going to have this DJ event, and it was going to be piled high with scientists. And so I proposed, well, let's add something to warm them up to get the dancing going. So that's when I proposed that we should do a dancer PhD contest. And I filmed it. And the story just kind of became a runaway hit. It was covered by the New York Times, and I was interviewed by CNN and The Guardian. And emails just started pouring in from all over the world, mm-hmm. from scientists saying, well, when's the next PhD dance? And, of course, there was no other PhD dance. So eventually, I think by the third dozen email, I realized I better organize one fast. And since these scientists were all over the world, including Australia, it couldn't be a real live event. I'd have to make it on YouTube.
You call yourself the Gonzo Scientist because you participate in the science that you cover. So will you be dancing?
So I participated in the first one. I guess I'd call it a surreal breakdance interpretation of a genetic network. I think there's an implicit rule that once you've danced your PhD, it can never be done again.
John Bohannon is a contributing correspondent for the journal Science, and he's the founder of the Dance Your PhD contest. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
And thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game. Evidence that we have not all the time pleased all the people arrived this week from one of the people we haven't pleased, Barbara Hansen, a New Yorker who listens to Only a Game via the podcast. Are you there, Bill? Ms. Hansen emailed. It's me, hockey. Has nothing of sufficient interest happened since that desultory preseason roundup? Really? The mysterious death by Russian medical malfeasance of the New York Rangers' first-round draft pick? The retirement of Patrick Roy's jersey? The hilarious all-star electronic ballot box stuffing by Montreal Canadiens fans in honor of their team's 100th season? No? Okay, then. I'm going to sit in the penalty box and sulk. of my commentary last week regarding the auctioning off of the heads of a water buffalo and various other animals shot by Ted Williams, Paul Converse, who hears the show on WYPR in Baltimore, wrote, "I generally agreed with your sentiments. Sadly, the few remaining water buffalo in Africa are a non-native species now restricted to a small park in northern Tunisia. Most likely, Williams did his hunting in East Africa, where Cape buffalo, a very different species, are relatively abundant. Let's hope this very agile, alert, and potentially dangerous animal survives for many generations to come." Sean Madden emailed this week in response to our story about Snowflex, the artificial skiing surface recently installed at Liberty University in Virginia. "I guess we'll be looking at less days of skiing where nature intended it to be," he wrote. "Yum, I can't wait until all our mountains are covered in petrochemicals. Awesome." And finally, Jesse Wiley, who hears the program on Minnesota Public Radio, went all creative on us this week, perhaps inspired when I wondered on last week's program if the unretired Brett Favre was still the biggest story in the NFL. Mr. Wiley sent us a little song meant to be sung to the tune of "If I Only Had a Brain" from The Wizard of Oz about how much better off the Minnesota Vikings would be if they had scooped up Favre when he decided he couldn't retire after all. The song is far too ambitious for me to recite all the lyrics, but perhaps part of a single stanza will suffice. "The Packers wouldn't mock us. We would all drink like Bacchus if Brett would play with us." You can send your comments, musical or otherwise, via our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
"For things I can't explain, then perhaps I'll deserve you and be even worthy of you if I only had a brain."
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Randy Goodman, a Missouri hunter, no doubt wishes he'd never bagged his most recent deer, or that he'd done a more complete job of bagging it. On November 19th, Goodman put down a 240-pound buck with two shots. That was that, Goodman thought, as he approached the animal. But the deer, hooves flailing, had other ideas, and it jumped up and hunted the hunter for what Goodman later called, quote, 15 seconds of hell. Eventually, Goodman got off two more shots, finally killing the deer. Then he noticed that his vest was covered with blood and that he felt dizzy. At the hospital, he was told this was because he'd suffered a concussion and needed 7 staples in his scalp. Oh, dear.
"Got that white-tailed fever in my heart, got that white-tailed fever in my soul, got that white-tailed fever, it's better than sex, it's better than the Super Bowl on the end."
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, stalking the tiger from La Jolla to Dubai and back. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for Look the Week's News. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Friday, a federal judge issued a temporary injunction against the National Football League, allowing 5 suspended NFL players to play this weekend. The issue was whether the NFL had failed to inform players that the dietary supplement called StarCaps was tainted with a banned diuretic. What motivation would the NFL have to withhold that sort of information?
I don't have any idea what the motivation of the NFL would be in withholding this information, unless it just wanted to rack up some scalps and enhance the credibility of its drug testing program. Otherwise, this doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, the argument the NFL has made against this lawsuit is not that we did our due diligence and the players are making up this cause of action. The argument the NFL is making against this lawsuit is that you're not allowed to file this kind of lawsuit based on their collective bargaining agreement. Nobody in the NFL is talking about why these players were kept in the dark. I don't know the ins and outs of the drug policy well enough to know whether or not it was their responsibility or the player's responsibility or the agent's responsibility to know this stuff. I do know that this is what happens when you start testing for steroids and then start testing for the masking agents of steroids and then start testing for the masking agents of the masking agents. Sooner or later, you're testing for stuff that's as far removed from the steroids as, you know, apple juice is from antifreeze.
Super Bowl XLII hero Plaxico Burress will probably not have the opportunity to reprise his performance in Super Bowl XLIII. He's been suspended for the final four games of the regular season for unlawful possession of the handgun with which he shot himself in the leg in a nightclub. Suspension redundant?
Probably not, but it puts the New York Giants on record with both the league and with young Mr. Burress that he's not going to be part of their plans in the foreseeable future.
Charlie Weiss will be returning to coach Notre Dame for a fifth year. I guess this is because his guys only lost to USC on Saturday by 35 points. Can the spread really have been that much?
I'm not exactly sure. I think that the argument that was made to keep Charlie Weiss on was that the buyout was too expensive for them to get rid of him this year. Apparently that carried the day in South Bend.
Tommy Tuberville, on the other hand, will not be returning to Auburn for an 11th season. I presume this is at least in part because Alabama is currently the number one team in the country.
That's very much part of why it is. Tommy Tuberville was 85-40 in 10 years at Auburn, including a 13-0 season in 2004. He will have a college coaching job in approximately 15 minutes.
In a gesture that might be characterized as anti-humanitarian, Ball State University declined an invitation to play a football game against Boise State on December 30th. The temptation to say, oh, the humanity is powerful indeed, but why doesn't Ball State want to play in the humanitarian bowl?
Well, in keeping with the season, the only thing I can think of is possibly they sent the humanitarian bowl an email beginning with the words, are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses? Is there no Meineke Car Care Bowl?
They're looking for a better one? They don't want to travel? Something like that. I don't know. Forbes magazine has announced its latest list of NBA team values. And for the fourth straight year, unless I've got the list upside down, the New York Knicks are at the top.
This is fabulous. This team is worth $613 million, despite the fact that the franchise has been an absolute circus over the last year.
It doesn't seem to matter, does it?
It's still a very valuable franchise.
So Enron stock is up to $700 a share, too. The National Hockey League has suspended Sean Avery for 6 games without pay, not for on-ice violence, but for remarks he made about his former girlfriends dating other hockey players, remarks which we will definitely not repeat here, by the way. Does the fact that the league has suspended a player for what he has said indicate a change in their public relations policy?
No, they're still really stupid. This is the single most ridiculous suspension in the history of professional sports. And it's coming from a league which suspended Randy Jones of the Philadelphia Flyers 2 games, 1/3 the amount Sean Avery got, for nearly killing the Bruins' Patrice Bergeron on the ice last year. This is simply preposterous. What is Gary Bettman thinking on this? He's got renegade players running around maiming people on the ice and getting 2 games, and meanwhile, a guy, a hockey player, gets crude and stupid. Call me shocked. Shocked, I tell you. And the guy gets 6 games for saying something nasty about an ex-girlfriend to the media? Believe me, Gary, you don't have any PR, so therefore you don't have to worry about the problems with it.
New York State Assemblyman Richard Brodsky is investigating New York City's deals with the Yankees and the Mets. Do recently released emails seem to indicate, I'm sorry I'm giggling when I'm reading this, but do they indicate that the Big Apple was prepared to take a bigger bite out of their baseball teams than had previously been reported?
Well, it seems that city officials were angling for the luxury boxes in the new baseball stadiums in New York City, and they were asking for things like free food.
Mm-hmm. The mayor.
I have a feeling that this is going to go down in history as the perfect storm of public money going down the stadium rat hole is having New York build 2 baseball stadiums at the same time. And this isn't even considering the incredibly big Krakatoa-sized rat hole in Brooklyn where they're trying to build the basketball arena.
Well, all I can say is it's a good thing the economy's in good shape or this would be a heck of a story. Sports Illustrated named Michael Phelps their Sportsman of the Year. No surprise there, I guess, Charlie.
No, not at all. This was the most predictable one they've had in a long time. Although I have to admit, the picture of him in the nice suit soaked with pool water on the cover is very close to the strangest photo I've ever seen on the cover of that magazine.
Do you suppose they were afraid that if they hadn't had him soaking wet, we'd have forgotten that he was a swimmer?
I mean, wasn't it better when they just wore the suit and the 8 medals? I mean, that was kind of a cool photo.
There was some class to that,
absolutely.
And finally, Charlie, a fish story. 21 years ago, Joe Richardson, who was messing around on Lake Sam Rayburn in Buna, Texas, lost his high school ring. And why is this a fish story?
Okay, now, we are believing this, right? At the holiday season, we're all trusting our fellow man.
Fish story.
Joe claims that over near Buna somewhere, on Lake Sam Rayburn, no less, somebody pulled out an 8-pound bass that had, undigested within it, his class ring that he lost 21 years ago. This is a Christmas miracle. This is a Hallmark TV movie waiting to happen. My Ring in the Fish, a Christmas story.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week, this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Is there no Pacific Life Holiday Bowl?
When the fishing gods are smiling, your creel will end up full. But if they're frowning on you, you ain't got a beer to pull. Fishing luck, it's a funny thing. Doesn't always go your way.
Takes a while. As Bob Smiley reports in the afterword of his new book, Follow the Roar, in 2008, Tiger Woods played in 7 official events worldwide. He won 5 of them, all with a torn anterior cruciate ligament and the last one with 2 stress fractures. Bob Smiley went along for the ride. All of it. Every shot. In every tournament. He joins me now from NPR West to discuss the adventure. Bob, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
You undertook the task of watching every shot Tiger Woods hit in 2008 with the idea that, quote, maybe Tiger Woods could teach me something. Did you mean like golf?
Well, I mean, that was part of it. You know, I've been a golfer since I was age 8, so that was definitely a factor. But sort of the jumping off point was me being at a low point in my writing career and sort of looking at Tigers in my parallel lives, at least through high school, both growing up in the same part of California roughly, and then sort of our two very divergent paths, his towards unstoppable success and me towards mediocrity. And what is he doing that I'm not is sort of the big question.
Oh, and what a big question it is. Yeah. At what point in your journey did you begin dreaming of Tiger Woods?
Well, sadly, I think it was day 2, and I had this very bizarre dream that Tiger invited me to dinner, and I showed up wearing a nice tweed jacket and a pair of underwear, and I knew that I was on my way to being obsessed with somebody who I'd only just started to follow.
In March of 2008, you began asking yourself if Tiger Woods could go undefeated. In retrospect, does that seem to you the point at which you'd lost your mind?
You know what? Even now, months later, it isn't that much of an impossibility when you look back on his year, because he had won 4 tournaments in a row going into the tournament in Miami, and that was a tournament that he ended up losing by 2 shots, and I think in my words, he putted like Frankenstein.
What a great image.
His level, when he's playing well, the difference between Tiger and second place is dramatic.
You had the opportunity to observe all sorts of Tiger Woods fans in the galleries, as I say, from Southern California to Dubai and back again. Tell us a little bit about some of the more extreme fans that you met or at least saw.
Yeah, well, one of my favorites, and I don't even know if this made it into the book, but there was, at the Arnold Palmer Invitational in Orlando, there was this great guy I met named Kenny Bass who had spent his last dollars just on his ticket to get into the tournament, and so when it started to rain, he was caught thoroughly off guard. And like most Tiger fans, bad weather is not going to scare them off. But he was freezing. I mean, he was shivering. And so Kenny tracked down a trash man, asked if he could have one of his trash bags, and sort of slithered into it, never making holes for his arms, just sort of this in cocoon almost, where he could barely waddle his feet. And he just waddled along down the fairway following Tiger. And I swear to you, if he had slipped or fallen down, he would not have been able to get up. But there's a fervor with a lot of Tiger fans. But you also get a lot of fans who don't even know much about golf, but they know Tiger, and they're impressed even with the worst shot he'll hit all day.
I have to say, my own favorite fan, described by you in this book, was the woman who said after Tiger had hit one shot rather close to her, "I tasted his divot."
It's very bizarre, you know, since Tiger's almost never going to turn to somebody and say, "Hey, how you doing?" The lengths that they go to find some personal story
some
they have.
Yeah.
Right, so there was the lady who tasted his divot. There was the other kid I met who was ecstatic when Tiger hit a sand shot out of a bunker and his eyes were filled with dirt. You know, surreal things that would never happen with any other golfer.
It will come as no surprise to listeners that you saw some magnificent shots while you followed Tiger Woods around these various golf courses. At 5:47 p.m. on the final day of the Arnold Palmer Invitational, you saw one of the best putts. Would you read your description of that shot for us?
I'd love to. 5:47 p.m. He takes two last strokes before stepping into the ball. As he draws the silver putter back, I notice a bird on the lake dive beneath the water. Dogs can sense earthquakes. Maybe loons can, too. The moment he hits it, the crowd starts to cheer, sounding like a distant wave that won't stop breaking. With the ball having traveled only 2 feet from Tiger's putter, someone in the back row of the bleachers stands and puts his hands up as if he already knows it's in. Now that is trust. The rest of the grandstands are on their feet when it's halfway to the hole and still on line. As the putt banks to the right, the cheers from those with better views continue to swell, and we take our cues from them, screaming the ball down toward the cup. I stop tracking the actual putt when I see Tiger take a few steps backwards. He's done it again. When it drops, Tiger turns and, in one glorious motion, slams his black TW hat to the ground. Taking my cue from him, I toss my own hat into the air and roar in delight. If there were only a way to harness the energy released around that green, it would power the city of Orlando for a week.
That's great. Eventually, did you come to believe that there was no shot Tiger Woods couldn't make?
Absolutely, but I'll tell you when I had my doubts was, you know, building towards that final momentous putt Sunday at the U.S. Open. You know, he had a 12-foot putt for birdie that he absolutely had to make to tie Rocco Media to force a Monday playoff. And the people around me who, you know, this was the only day they'd seen Tiger all year, of course thought it was in. But after seeing everything he had done around the globe all year, that was a moment where I thought, has his magic run out? Is there an end to what he can really do? And sure enough, he made it again.
Well, as you say, for Tiger Woods, the 2008 golf season did end with the U.S. Open, and it ended successfully. But you describe 10 especially revealing seconds during that tournament when Woods wasn't even swinging a golf club. What was it that you saw?
Well, you know, a lot of people may have already forgotten, but after the Masters, he had his first knee surgery of the year, and he was gone. He disappeared for 2 months, rehabbing from that. And so when he came back at the U.S. Open, he said everything was fine, and everybody sort of believed it. And so he played his first round, and he played the first 17 holes, kind of mediocrely, nothing too spectacular. And he came to the 18th tee. He lined up a little down the left side and just hit this high, soaring cut straight down that landed right in the middle of the fairway. And the crowd cheered, and it was a perfect shot. And I watched Tiger, and he didn't do his normal sort of twirl of the driver and casually pick up his tee. He just stood there, frozen, and the club just slid between his hands. And he turned around, and he walked just back to his caddy. And he didn't limp. But I could tell after watching him all year that this was a different look. This wasn't the cold kind of steely glare. This was, you know, really a fragility that Tiger hadn't shown ever before during a round, as far as I'm concerned. And that was really a moment where everybody who saw that should have realized he's hurt and something's wrong. And obviously, as the week went on, we found out how hurt he really was.
What did you end up knowing about Tiger Woods that you didn't know before you began following him around the golf courses?
Well, the U.S. Open sort of showed it in a different way, but he's not a robot. He's not some heavenly being, although he has, you know, these God-given talents. But what Tiger has is something that requires a lot more hard work than I think a lot of people give him credit for. He's somebody who doesn't neglect any area of his golf game, whether it be physical or mental, and he sort of recognizes the self-discipline and the hard work that's really necessary to keep up that level of play. And so for me, what I really walked away with was a real conviction about how lazy I am and how much harder I need to work at everything, whether it's being a husband, you know, being a father, being a writer. You know, I think Tiger's a great example for everybody. Even if you never pick up a golf club in your life, really what it means to be dedicated to doing something well.
Right. Well, Bob, you've become something of a Tiger Woods expert. I don't think probably there's anybody who saw him hit as many golf shots in 2008 as you did. So what do you anticipate will happen when Tiger Woods begins playing golf again?
You know, I think this probably scared him a little bit. I sort of think that, you know, he did sort of grasp for once, you know, his own fragility a little more. And so I think he's going to really take his time. I think he'll probably come back in March. He'll show up at one of the tournaments in Florida, either Doral or the Arnold Palmer Invitational, to defend his title, just to get at least one tournament in before the Masters. And I really expect him to be at least as good, even if he has to change his swing a little bit and the way he sort of lashed at the ball for the last 12 years.
Bob Smiley is the author of Follow the Roar, Tailing Tiger for All 604 Holes of His Most Spectacular Season. It's published by Harper. He joined me from the studios of NPR West. Bob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. My pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Erica Bailey. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Follow the Roar author Bob Smiley, who presents a holiday shopping conundrum.
What do you buy the guy who has everything for Christmas? I have a great recommendation on a book.
It's a conundrum because I think he means Only a Game, a collection of radio essays by some guy who hosts a public radio sports show. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.